Accession number 28361, reel 37.
General Julian Thompson, reel 37.
You were retraining specifically for an exercise due to take place in the Mediterranean.
That's right. Which we were going out in two LSLs, which again is not very satisfactory, but it was the best they could provide.
Right.
And we sailed from England through the Straits of Gibraltar, stopped in Gibraltar to enable us to run to the top of a rock.
The usual thing.
Which I'd done before. And then we went to Sardinia, to the training area in Sardinia, at the bottom end of Sardinia, which is a live firing range. Mm-hmm. Though we didn't actually do any live firing, and on the exercise we did some live firing afterwards, and we did an exercise of our own training. We didn't have a formal enemy, and then we did some.
What scale was this? Was this the whole brigade?
Or no, this is just one commander. That's all. I put some enemy of my own out.
Yeah.
And then we were involved. We then re-embarked and did a landing with the American Marines in Sardinia, and then did some training, live mortar firing and some pretty rudimentary field firing. Mm. And then we embarked in the LSLs and sailed to the eastern Mediterranean to do an exercise in Greece. We did a rehearsal off Crete, and then we went to the southern part of the Peloponnese to do an exercise in Greece with the American Marines. And in fact, I embarked, a lot of the commando, into the American LPH, because we were flown off. We didn't have any of our own helicopters, except some scouts, to fly in the CH-53s off the American carrier. And we did this exercise in Greece, which was not very long. It was only about 3 days. Mm. And then we came home.
Now, you'd done this sort of thing before when you were brigade major, weren't
sure.
you?
Sure, yeah.
Had things changed at all since? You know, with regard to the form of exercises and their style and the way the Americans thought about things and did things?
They rarely hadn't changed very much in the intervening 5 years. American Marines' morale and discipline was better than it had been in 72, 73, when I'd first come across them, when the Vietnam War was still on, of course, didn't end in 1975. And they were recovering from that. They were still in a pretty rocky condition, but they were better. By rocky, I mean their morale was low. I think their whole sort of officer management was bad. Mm. I mean, I took quite a lot of my people on board this American carrier, LPH, from which we were going to do an assault, and they of course had to go into the Marines accommodation on board because one of their companies had moved out, and so we were able to slide in and they were light anyway, so we fitted in. And I remember saying to the chap who met me, I want to see where my chaps are going to be. I want to go and have a look, see what it's like. And he was astonished that I should want to go and do this. He just thought it was quite bizarre.
Well, you should take an interest in the men's accommodation.
You know, and later, I did go and find out, and then I would go, we were there on board for about 3 days, I used to go around every day with the RSM and see what was going on. Because it's mind-numbingly boring in one of those LPHs. The Americans have no concept of keeping people busy and trained, while they were at sea.
What sort of accommodation did they have then?
They had big spaces with quite high deck heads or ceiling, but they had racks of bunks. Mm. So they were crammed in pretty tight. There's not much space for any kit. It was absolutely filthy, crabby, with sort of sort of litter all over the place.
Well, it hadn't been cleaned.
I mean, my brain's obviously horrified at it. And so they immediately set to and started cleaning it up. But it's filthy. And there's practically no, as far as I can see, sort of interaction between the officers and the troops when they're at sea. The officers all live in the sort of different part of the ship, which is fairly normal. But they never seem to descend. They never seem to go down and find out what their chaps are up to. Mm. And there's no formalised, as far as I can see, training or programme of keeping people busy. It was left to the individual to go and keep themselves fit or do whatever.
Oh.
And you could only go on the flight deck for an hour every evening, because the rest of the time the aviators ran it, and no one else was allowed on the flight deck. Because we in the LPH always used to have a space on the flight deck, unless they were doing a full flying program, sort of marked off for us to do training on, because
yes.
It recognised you had to train and keep people fit.
Mm.
So I was, you know, I thought to myself, I'm glad I didn't have to spend too long here.
Quite. Mm. What about the business of being prepared to accept that improvements might be necessary in the actual performance?
I didn't actually discuss it with them, really.
Mm.
I mean, I didn't think it was my place to tell them that I thought they were needed sharpening up.
Mm.
I just came away with that impression.
Mm. And what the landings in Sardinia and Greece, did they go, you know, according to normal
yes,
pattern?
Yes, I mean they were pretty they were pretty unimaginative. They were
yes.
pretty there was no great deal to them. They were pretty sort of mechanistic.
Mm.
And the exercise in Greece, I say, only lasted about 2 days and two nights, I think it was.
Yeah.
And it was very much recognisably a NATO exercise, in that the Greeks were taking place, and though the Turks were originally meant to take part, they wouldn't. So it was Greeks, Americans, Brits, Dutch. And everyone had to have their sort of slice of the action, everyone had to be sort of fairly treated, and everyone had to do well.
Oh. Yes.
You know, one of those.
Oh dear, yes.
And I slightly irritated the American. I was under an American brigade commander who gave me a task of securing an objective which involved, and I was going to fly. He gave me some CH-53s to lift my guys from one place to the other, and I decided I'd land right on the bloody objective. And I wasn't going to land where he wanted me to land, which was the top of a hill, and then have to walk down about 2,000 feet and a forward slope in full view of the objective, which struck me as being absolutely bonkers.
Mm.
And there was quite a good covered approach to the objective up a valley. And what I did was I put my recce troop out to secure the landing site during the night, and they reported that it was clear.
Mm.
It was as if there were a few enemy, not many. And so I said, well, land right on it. So I led them the attack in my scout with a smoke grenade. And as I flew over the objective, I tossed the grenade out, and the CH-53s came in and landed all the guys. And at that moment, the recce troop leapt to their feet, and the few enemy were there ran off. And afterwards, the old American brigade commander said, oh, you can't do that. I said, well, we did it, and it would have worked. Didn't like that.
Who were the enemy? Were they Greeks?
The enemy were Greeks, yeah.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah.
How did the Dutch do? Because you described...
Well, the Dutch weren't under my command. There was a Dutch company, which was a company that was normally attached to 45 Commando, and they were independent.
Mm. But you described earlier on how you retrained the Dutch and British tactical methods and so
on. I think they did all right. I didn't see them, so I don't know how they did.
Mm.
They weren't sort of in my part at all. Yeah. So that was that exercise. And that was the end. I then came back and I then handed over command at the end of 2.5 years.
Huh.
I handed over command in June 1990. Sorry, what are we talking about? 1978. Yes, June 1978.
And had you been given warning in advance?
Oh, yes. I was told I was going to go off to be the what was then called, in those days, the Colonel GS of an organisation called Commando Forces, which was the sort of formation that sat above the Commando Brigade. Mm. I was affected. I mean, I was the Chief of Staff, really.
Yeah. And who was the overall commander of Commando Forces?
Yeah, the Commando Forces was commanded by a chap called Robin Pringle.
Oh, yes.
Who was then a Major General and didn't have any injuries to his legs. Mm. and I did that job for about 18 months, I suppose, and then I went off to the RCDS.
Mm. What was the point of having an HQ Commando Forces if you've got a brigade HQ for the commandos?
Because, sorry, I'll tell you in a minute.
I was asking you why you needed another headquarters by commando.
Yeah. I mean,
brigade headquarters.
It was a hangover from the days when the Royal Marines were geographically divided into two sort of areas, Plymouth and Portsmouth, with a Major General in charge of each, and they divided the Royal Marines up between them geographically. They then changed it to Commando Forces and Training Forces, and the Training Major General looked after all the training, the SBS and the reserves. Mm. And Commando Forces originally had two parts, in that the brigade only took under command part of the commando forces, and the other part was sort of independent under Scotland. So this thing sat over two bits. It was quite frankly a complete waste of time. and it was jobs for the boys, really. It was a way of getting another two-star job for the Royal Marines. It doesn't exist anymore.
Mm. It does sound rather like a duplication.
It was exactly that.
Effort.
It was exactly that, really. It was useful having a two-star to keep senior navy off the backs of the brigade commander one star, because of the sort of very seniority conscience way that the navy work, and they don't recognize anybody under two star as being having any importance. It you needed that sort of two star level clout to deal with, you know, the navy, really, effectively.
Mm. So what did the Colonel GS do? What was his?
Well, Colonel GS was the Chief of Staff. Mm. And in fact, what actually happened was that the sort of what I call the policy was done by Commando Forces, and the day-to-day business of training, operations and so on was done by the Commando Brigade. Mm. And at that time, it's quite interesting because the army, you probably remember, in the late 70s, the army had done away with brigades, and they had task forces or something, which they created from divisions.
Field forces,
that's right.
You could have five or seven major units under a single commander.
Yeah. It was a dotty idea, in my opinion. Mm. And I'm happy to say the Royal Marines, because they're always a bit behind the game when it comes to changing things, hadn't cottoned on that this was going on until they then suddenly came up with the notion that this would be a good idea. And the way that they did it, I mean, the way the army did it and the way the Royal Marines were going to do it was that there was no field force headquarters. They were ad hoc originally. So the sort of Colonel GS of a division became the brigade commander of the field, or the field force commander. And I said, this is dotty, because actually what you've got to have is a formation that trains all the time together, not an ad hoc headquarters. And I pleaded, I remember, not for it not to happen. There was some, I have to say, self-interest in that I was suspected I was going to be the next brigade commander. I didn't want to see my brigade disbanded before I took it over. So and it never happened in the end. Mm.
What line did, was it Sir Stuart Pringle, wasn't it, eventually?
He was Sir Stuart Pringle, yeah. He was Sir Stuart, he was a baronet. He was Sir Stuart then, yeah.
Ah. What line did he take on that?
He agreed with
question?
Me. He agreed. Mm. He didn't like it at all. Mm. So the training of the brigade was done by the brigade, quite rightly. Day-to-day operations were the brigade. And the commando forces rarely did administration of the base, really. there wasn't really enough work. I mean, it wasn't a very hard job being the Colonel GS of Commando Forces.
Was there any pressure from any quarter on the Marines to adopt the same system as the Army had?
No.
Take
that. No, it wasn't. It was the Army didn't say you should do that because we've done it.
Mm. Well, they had no authority to do that.
They had no authority to do that. It was just the then Chief of Staff in London thought it would be a good idea because they might be able to save manpower and therefore money.
Yes.
In fact, luckily, what happened, I think what wasn't my pleading that won the day, it was the fact the Army binned it and went back to the other.
Mm.
And, you know, one was able to parade all the reasons why they'd gone back. So do we actually want to sort of go and do something that they've discovered as being is ridiculous?
Yeah. Were there any other major issues of policy that came up besides that question of organisation, headquarters and so on?
I can't remember any.
Mm.
Oh, I suppose there was one actually that was quite interesting, which was not policy that I had anything to do with. That stage, when I took over, the Callaghan government was still in charge, and we were going to get another amphibious ship, which was going to be pretty much a poor man's amphibious ship, but it would be better than nothing, which was going to be an RFA, a Royal Fleet Auxiliary freighter, converted to what the Americans would call an assault or an attack transport, which is a ship that carries a few landing craft but quite a lot of people, but it's really just a way of getting people to the scene, and then you have to put them onto landing craft to land them. And this was all going to go ahead and was one of the things cancelled by the Conservative government when they got in 1979. And it was quite interesting because it proved to me that the Conservatives actually on the whole tend to be worse for defence than Labour.
Mm.
Actually, you know, there were a whole lot of cost cutting exercises came in, you probably remember.
Indeed. Yes.
With various people coming in and various projects were axed, culminating in the not defence review of 1981.
Mm. There seemed to be an attitude at the time, we'll pay for something and buy it when we find we need it.
Yes.
Which is rather a commercial view.
That still pertains now, of course.
Demand will be met by supply without taking any account of the strategic implications of a time lag.
That still happens now, mind you.
Of course.
You know, the things like boots and tentage and weapons and ammunition and things like that.
Yes.
But that ship was cancelled as a cost-cutting exercise. And I suppose the sort of defence outlook at that time was there were the four armoured divisions in Germany. There was RAF Germany, and they were the sort of important bits. Quotation marks. There was the deterrent, i.e. Polaris, soon to be Trident, or eventually to be Trident. And then there was a sort of anti-submarine bit of the Royal Navy whose job was to survive long enough for the convoys to come across the Atlantic, bringing American reinforcement to Europe. And everything else was just a waste of time, including the Royal Marines. And so that was the sort of, putting it crudely, the sort of defence picture at the time.
So you got the question of the ship coming up.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't have any input into it. It was just because all I knew, it was going on at the time, and one of my staff was permanently assigned to bringing the ship into service and being the chap in charge of it, but it never happened.
was it a large staff, the headquarters, commando forces?
I mean, there was a Colonel GS as me, there was a Colonel AQ, who was always Royal Corps of Transport. There was, I had a G1, some G2s.
Mm.
It wasn't large headquarters, no. Mm.
Where was it located?
It was located in Plymouth, in a place called Hamo's House.
Oh, yes.
Which was rather a nice house, which had been, I don't know who it had been built for originally. I think it had originally been built for the Flag Officer of Plymouth, I think. It had a ballroom. It was a sort of mid-Victorian effort. The ballroom was very useful for conferences.
Mm. Did you ever have a ball in it?
No. Not that I remember. No, we didn't. Not during my time, anyway, no.
Perhaps, do you think possibly they decided that having had a fairly strenuous time commanding the commander, you required a certain amount of slack time?
I don't think that entered into our calculations at all, really. Mm. It was just that I was being promoted to full colonel and I needed to be given a colonel's job, and I was very happy to go and do that job because it suited me very well, because I was able to carry on sailing, which is what I used to do a lot of in those days. I lived in a very agreeable house right down by what is now the Brittany Ferry Terminal in Plymouth, and had a very nice 18 months, really.
And then it was RCDS.
Then it was RCDS, yes.
Those days still at Latimer?
No, the RCDS is where it is now, at Belgrave Square. Latimer was the old NDC.
Ah, yes.
Now, Latimer was the National Defence College or the Joint Services Staff College before that it was called, and was a Brit only course, so I didn't do it, but you could do up to secret, whereas RCDS was very much full of overseas students. In fact, probably wouldn't have existed had it not been for the over 50% foreigners. Who attended and paid for the rest of us, I suspect.
What did you do then at RCDS? What was on the course?
RCDS was I'm never quite sure what its aim was, actually. I suspect it probably doesn't know what it is now.
Aim number one, survival.
Survival. I think it was regarded as a bit of a rest cure. As somebody once described it to me, when the hall porter says to you, "Good night, sir," at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, he means it. you didn't do much work in the afternoons. I wasn't quite sure what it was trying to do. I think it was trying to train potential senior officers in having a sort of broad defence industrial / foreign office view of the world scene, to prepare them for senior jobs subsequently. I don't reckon it actually did prepare you for senior jobs, and it was certainly nothing like as good as the course, which in a way is a sort of rival course now, the Higher Command and Staff Course, which Ginger Bagnold started, which is a war-fighting course at the operational level.
Yes.
This was not a war-fighting course in any sense of the word. It wasn't a war-fighting course at all. You didn't study tactics, operational level, or even strategic issues. It was sort of... It probably prepared you to be someone like Eisenhower.
A military diplomat.
A military diplomat. A generalissimo. I think that was a very agreeable way of spending a year, sort of marking time before I became a brigade commander. But I can't say that I actually learnt anything on the course. I had a very pleasant flat in London, used to walk to work, and the pace of the instruction was very slow. You got in and had a cup of coffee, and then there was a lecture after coffee, where some guy came and lectured you with questions, and then you had lunch and went home. Very occasionally there'd be a sort of syndicate discussion in the afternoon. and we started, I remember the first 3 weeks were lectures on the economy in its broadest sense. I mean, not just the British economy, but economy, a national economy. And we had a lecture every day for 3 weeks, that's 15 days lectures, and we had 15 different views on how economies worked. And at the end of it, I realised that's why the economy's in such a mess, because no one can make their minds up how it should work.
Perhaps nobody fully understands.
Nobody fully understands it. No.
Did you have to do any written work as part
of
this?
Yes, you had to produce a sort of essay, thesis. I can't remember what they called it. At the end of the commandant's paper or something, they called it. And I did one which basically argued that you could double earmark people like the commando brigade for their NATO tasks and what was then in the jargon called out-of-area tasks. So you didn't need to have extra people, but you could double earmark, and you could double earmark shipping and so on. And our papers were sent to the sort of relevant departments in the MOD and sent to, I don't know, sort of two-star guys to look at. And mine came back saying, this is a complete waste of time. There never will be any out-of-area operations. This is 1980.
Indeed. Well, you know, it was sometime after the government had announced that we couldn't afford to be a world power. And,
yeah. Yes. Right. And of course, the not defence review hadn't actually happened at that stage, but it was about to happen. He just moved in.
Yes.
There were lots of cuts being forecast, and lots of gloomy prognostications about what was going to happen to the Royal Marines. So it was not a very happy time, really.
Did you think your own prospects were beginning to diminish?
I just began to wonder, yes. I didn't, you know, I always hoped that something would turn up. Anyway, it was a year, it was quite fun. Perhaps the most interesting thing was the we did a tour which lasted a month, and you went to various places. You chose where you'd like to go, and sometimes you got your choice and sometimes you didn't. And I went in a group to Yugoslavia, which still existed in 1980 as a place. Tito had only died the year before. And Austria and Portugal and Spain.
What was the idea behind the tour?
The idea behind the tour was to sort of let you see other bits of the world and gain an insight into how other people's economies and industry and armed forces and governments worked. Again, it was a very what I call a very agreeable thing to do. I'm not sure that it had any great value, actually.
Who looked after you in these countries?
Well, what happened was the tour was fixed by the British embassy there and the host country, and you were very much looked after by the military attaché, defence attaché, naval attaché, whatever. But you were taken to a factory or making tanks or a barracks or a unit or an air base or a naval base according to what your host country would allow you to go to.
So the attaché would negotiate.
The attaché would negotiate and he had you for a week. It was a 4-week tour. As far as we can say, a week in Yugoslavia, a week in Austria, a week in Portugal, a week in Spain. And it depended, a whole lot of things depended on how good it was, on how sort of pushy and go-ahead the attaché was, how cooperative the hosts were, and really what there was to see or what they would allow you to see. Yugoslavia, we spent most of our time sunbathing on the Dalmatian coast. A, because the attachés were idle, and B, I think the Yugoslavs were not inclined to let us see anything of any importance. And we saw hardly anything of Yugoslav armed forces.
Well, by that stage, the Yugoslav armed forces had probably been showing some signs of strain.
I think they were, and people were already saying, you know, this thing's going to break up. Though they weren't talking about it overtly, I imagine the seeds were there.
Well, the country had been united by external forces in when it was created.
And then Tito had held it together. So it was beginning to sort of fragment, I suppose. But we were not aware of it in 1980, that it was about to fragment.
Now, what about Austria? Because Austria at that time, I think, was...